Cambridge Arts Roundup with Simon Burton.
Cambridge Radio.
Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to the Cambridge Arts Roundup Hour, where we'll learn about the art of beautiful movement, sample love in a noir musical, and we'll visit a house that has a story to tell of one man's artistic expression in a repressive age. In this edition, we talk to the directors of the Infusion Physical Theatre Dance Company and find out what is behind their exciting and excellent performance, Soothe, Dance and Brain Chemistry. We go backstage at Cambridge Operatic Society with the director and lead actor of Guys and Dolls at Cambridge Arts Theatre and get a taste of what it's like to be amateurs facing a show's debut earlier this month. And we return for a second instalment on the fascinating and quirky Cambridge Museum, David Parr House in Guider Street, with museum guide Bob Hewis. When you see a piece of dance that really uplifts you and takes you on a journey through an intriguing narrative, you perhaps witness how the body can convey and touch emotion and inner themes in a kind of thought-provoking logic. I find it speaks volumes to the soul because it expresses our humanity. Well, during the Cambridge Alumni Weekend, I visited West Road Concert Hall to see a piece called Soothe, Dance and Brain Chemistry, by the award-winning Infusion Physical Theatre Dance Company, which I have to say was nothing short of a breathtaking achievement. It explores adrenaline, dopamine and oxytocin, the hormones that push, pull and drag us through life. The piece, which takes a full 50 minutes to play out, is packed with thoughtful sophistication, as five dancers explore the physical and emotional effects of the molecules that make us move. Infusion works closely with the University of Cambridge's top biochemistry and psychology researchers, Professor Frook and Professor Balin. Artistic director Daniel Cossette and his wife and co-director founder Melanie perform with dancers Rachel Riveros, Holly Wilmot and Liesl de Walters and have carried out a string of award-winning projects. They dropped into Cambridge Radio to share their thoughts. What is the story behind Soothe as a piece?
Soothe is about the chemistry of emotional regulation. We were looking into CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, just so we could help calm our nerves after the stress of COVID lockdowns. For a lot of people, it was very intense, very stressful, and we found that. And so in that process, we discovered that there are three primary emotional states that our brain and body have to regulate through, and that they have very real physical ramifications for us. And so whether adrenaline is in your system because you feel threatened or you feel endangered, and that causes your heart to beat harder, and you might feel heart palpitations or have breathing difficulties, or whether it's because you you have a lot of dopamine in your system, you feel motivated, you want to get things done, but then what happens if those things can't be achieved instead of getting the reward for your payoff? And then finally, we discovered the soothe system, which is powered by oxytocin, and that's about how we calm down, that's how we recover, that's how we experience safety and peace, and that's comes often and most effectively through connection, and that comes from being with people, a positive physical touch, positive eye contact, and finding that oxytocin molecule to and getting that neuropeptide to form in the brain and body has longer lasting benefits and results. But we thought all of this is very physical. Our emotions are physical, the reactions are physical, and why wouldn't dance be a great way to explore that? Because you put these words into a dance studio like a dress adrenaline and fight, flight, freeze, and you've already got the makings of movement. And so let's do that.
There are basically three chapters in the narrative.
Yes.
And you are expressing that whole psychological and physical thing in a very beautifully choreographed piece of dance.
Yeah.
That must have been difficult to put together.
So the way we worked it out is that we gave movement prompts or just word prompts to our other dancers, and we all worked collaboratively on the choreography. And we also hauled in a couple of professors from Cambridge University, Professor Liliana Frook and David Bellin, and they helped us with the scientific underpinning of the show. So from psychology side, but also from bio-nano engineering, from the chemistry side of things.
And you had wonderful black backdrops at West Road, which showed the science and the evidence base of what you were doing as well, which kind of made it seem very concrete, you know, as a piece. I thought that was absolutely great.
Yeah.
When you're making an emotive piece of dance, what goes through your mind? You know, because there's lots of beautiful movements in it. There's lots of moments where things happen that are surprising or delightful and what have you. It must be quite a... I mean, is it like kind of composing a piece of music where you realise certain things fit together and other things perhaps don't, and it's finding those moments where basically you touch the audience's psyche with movement in a very beautiful way. I mean, how do you put that together?
We used a number of prompts and things to inspire us. Sometimes we would take colors and we would say, which color do you think this relates to which system? And that would generate a particular kind of movement. And then we would look at it and we'd say, all right, if we turned off the music that we had in the background, does it still feel like it's communicating threat or does it feel like it's communicating drive? And so we'd look for sort of happy coincidences where we could meld movements together. Or we would put on a video camera and we would say, all right, everybody, you have to stay connected, but you have to move. And then as we move, someone will say reverse and see, can you turn it backwards and redo something that you just did, which was very interesting, and how can we create that moment? And then we look at the video and we see how to reverse engineer it. And so a number of different ways.
I love that expression of emotion through movement and all of those kind of very kind of, I don't know what you would say, charged moments during it, which there's a great sort of tension at various moments during the dance. And it really was a fabulous piece. How fit do you need to be to actually manage to create a relatively, well, I would say almost totally flawless performance and maintain the speed and the pace over such a long period of time? That must be the concentration must be incredible.
Yes.
Yeah, I think dancers keep up their training and they we try to keep physically fit.
There's a mix
properly.
Of cardio, but we also have to do strength training because we're really interested in partnering, but in non-traditional ways. Mm-hmm. So you will have seen, but for those who haven't seen the show, we're not interested in maybe a ballet lift where a guy just pushes a girl above his head, but can the girls lift the guys? Can one person lift two people? And can we toss each other from here to there? Since the show is so much about connection, finding that trust and finding that balance, but also being fit enough that it doesn't break us in the process.
It's a massively visual thing. Who made the costumes and how did that all come together?
We we looked at various costume ideas, and then we found these leotards, for the want of a better word, that had like this cell-like structure. So really enjoyed that, and so we just hunted, you know, in shops, finding, you know, various bits of costumes and putting those together. It's not the first iteration of costumes that we've had for this show. When we first took it to the Edinburgh Fringe, we had something else and it really didn't work.
It was just whatever we found in the thrift store. But we've taken a step up, and Melanie masterminded the sort of chemically inspired formations, and taking those hexagons and bringing in the colors, you know, each in a scientific diagram, each of the colors will represent a different molecule, hydrogen, oxygen, and so we used the colors from sort of that wheel to add to the costume base.
How important is it for you to have a platform like West Road, and where are you performing next? Because I'm sure a lot of people would love to see this show. I was just totally blown away by it. I thought it was amazing.
Yeah, it's super important. Places like West Road Concert Hall has a good sized stage, so finding a venue that has a good sized stage for dance, and the proportion to the audience size as well, for dance audiences, is really important.
Now, how do you work together as a group? Because there are four of you, aren't there, in this piece?
That's right.
What happens when you're working together? Are there kind of tensions? Are there exciting moments? Are there terrible mistakes, injuries, all kinds of things like that happen behind the scenes when you're practicing?
Fortunately, no. This is a really tight-knit group, and we've been working together now for some of us for 6 or 7 years, I think. And just
there's
really
a lot of trust, and that's really important, actually. Trust also when things go wrong, because, you know, you said flawless, but perhaps apparently flawless, you know. Yes, exactly, cleverly hidden. So really important to trust your technicians that if something goes wrong, that they'll figure something out.
I think there's quite a lot of trust when people lift you off the ground and all things like that. They're going to not slip or make any kind of a mistake, because
exactly,
that must be terrible.
Indeed, and we've had independent moments when, say, a prop that I was having to do a cartwheel off flipped sideways and I fell and I had a massive bruise on my leg, and we had to re-choreograph segments of the show to accommodate it because I couldn't do any lifting there. But other times something might happen where we had the power cut out from the sound desk and the music didn't go on for about 6 minutes, and so we had to stand there, and one of our dancers was the main focus, and she just held the space and kept it calm, and everybody thought it was a really beautiful meditative moment of silence, and just pulled it through.
What is the dance scene like in Cambridge at the moment? I mean, there were lots of people doing dance things, like the College of Contemporary Arts and various other kind of groups like that were doing dance, but how much is going on, and how do you see your place in all of that?
I think it's growing, actually. There's lots of small independent groups that are not yet or not fully networked, but we're seeing a return to Cambridge of a lot of dancers who maybe grew up here and went off to Birmingham or London, and we're excited about that because we think there'll be more collaboration. And I think we're going to watch as the dance space here gets more and more exciting from local artists, not just people who come through the big theaters.
And so we like to gather people, actually. So if any one of your listeners, if they're dancers and they want to kind of connect with us,
look us up, Infusion
Physical
come
Theater.
Dance with us.
Yep.
We're hoping to be at the Cambridge this April, and there have been some delays in funding, but that should come back round in the autumn. So I would say look for us, hopefully, at the Cambridge Junction. We're also doing a push for some more national touring, so we're planning to go up to Hull. We might go out to Bedford and a few other places. So right now, the best place to keep an eye open is our website, infusionphysicaltheatre.net, and kind of get into the flow of what is happening with us.
And in the meantime, we're doing a bit of teaching in various primary and secondary schools here in and around Cambridge.
Do you travel in Europe as well? Is that something that you do to go and see other dance groups in Europe?
We do. We'd like to do a few festivals in Europe. We've got our eyes on Project Dance Paris, and some festivals in Switzerland and Austria, so that's in the plan. We just are continuing to grow and reach into the community, so we love it when people come and dance in our community classes, but also we're looking for partners who would like us to come and teach workshops for various community groups. And so if you're part of a group and you'd like to bring us to you, we'd love that as well. So just reach out.
Cambridge Arts Roundup with Simon Burton.
This is Cambridge Radio.
Just what is it about American gangsters and hustlers that make them the unlikely catalysts for feelings of romantic love? Is it that deep down they're good guys, perhaps? Cambridge Operatic Society's amateur production of Guys and Dolls has just had its debut at Cambridge Arts Theatre in the second week in January. And it's in many ways a topical Broadway hit to be staging in troubled times, as the 1920s and 30s are horribly reminiscent of the society of today. A lovable rogue, Nathan Detroit, seeks a venue for his illicit craps game, while the charming Skye Masterson makes a bet that he can win the heart of Sarah Brown, a determined sergeant of the Save a Soul mission. The musical, first staged in 1950, is composed by Frank Losser and based on a book by Joe Swirling and Abe Burrows. It's based on The Idol of Miss Sarah Brown, 1933, and Blood Pressure, which are two short stories by Damon Runyon, and also borrows characters and plot elements from other Runyon stories, such as Pick the Winner. Reworking Guys and Girls' noir backdrop for today's audience has been a challenging task, translating a tale and its well-known numbers into a show that cooks once again, as it did on Broadway. The moral of the story is, perhaps, that nice girls really shouldn't go out to play with boys, as Marilyn Monroe once put it in a song. Well, I caught up with Helen Petrovna, the director, and Saskia Edwards-Karolczuk, who plays Sarah Brown, as they prepared for the opening night, to find out how they got it together.
I am local to the area. I've lived in Cambridge for about 5 years now. Sarah Brown is always a role that I've had my eye on, having graduated drama school a few years ago. And when the role came up, I simply couldn't resist auditioning. And the opportunity to work with a professional creative team as well is, really comes up very infrequently.
Now, this is a 1950s musical originally. It was one of the most popular musicals ever to hit Broadway. Can you tell me a little bit about the writers and the background to the work?
Yeah, sure. I mean, a lot of it is based on Damon Runyon's classic stories. He was a short story novelist, and he created these wonderful caricatures of what was happening in the 50s at the time, the gambling culture. There'd been massive political shifts post the war, and so he captured that in a really witty and charming way, which kind of counteracted the negative stereotypes that there were around illegal gambling at the time.
Now, obviously, stories about gangsters and hustlers and things are romanticised in this drama.
Somewhat.
What's it like for you? Your character, Saskia, is the main character, Sarah Brown. What happens to her in this world?
Well, without giving too many spoilers away, Sarah Brown is really someone who superficially has been raised with a very clear sense of what is right and wrong. And through being exposed to this world that we're exploring in the 50s of this gambling, and actually it's a really journey of discovery for her and understanding that maybe things aren't quite so black and white, and there's a place where you can exist comfortably in the grey area, and exploring how that feels is really a beautiful journey of self-discovery for her to go on, and for the other characters as well.
Sort of generating sparks in an unlikely place is very much a kind of dramatic setting, isn't it? So you have lots of very emotive things in that world and for the characters to respond to. Can you tell me a little bit about the dynamics of the characterisation in it?
Yeah, so specifically for this, because it opened on Broadway in 1951, we very specifically chosen to set it in 1952, our production, because of what was going on politically. So we use a lot of advertisements from the time, so our characters are surrounded by what's happening in their world. We also delve into what's happening in Cuba, which is obviously just post the Batista coup, which is a really fascinating journey for Sarah as well, and kind of her growth and realisation. So we use a lot of the realism of what's happening in 1952.
Now you're stepping into the shoes of some great actors who've played these parts, like Marlon Brando, and Frank Sinatra, and Gene Simmons have all played parts in it, which are very memorable, and there's lots of versions all the way through. How does your version differ from the more recent versions of Guys and Dolls? What makes it distinct?
Well, for us, that's a challenge, right? Because the songs are very, very familiar. And of course, in musical theatre, you want to avoid people crooning along. You want them to focus on the story. And so we've really played around with screwball and film noir delivery to to make sure that the delivery of that doesn't slip into sort of a song that sounds like a Sinatra tribute album. Not because that's not wonderful, but because you want people focused and engaged in the dynamism of what's going on. So that's been an exciting challenge for us to play with.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the innovations that the actors and choreographers have made on stage and how difficult it was to achieve them?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a real privilege to observe my fellow cast members really getting into the Runyonese dialect, really practicing with that. Quite a challenge, but you know, really well executed. We've, as Helen mentioned, around avoiding that tribute act feel. So we've been looking at a lot of screwball comedy, a lot of film noir clips for inspiration, but also understanding, you know, how. Where are those grey areas that we can explore, and what is the more modern twist on these kind of legacy characters? There's the amount of detail that Helen and David have put into this production and really grounding it in 1952 has allowed us to explore that depth a lot more, because it makes it feel a lot more real to us.
What happens with the dance numbers? Which classics do you like the most?
Wow. It is filled with classics. Mm. I love Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat. A lot of the Crapshooters ballet, Crapshooters dancing. The choreography is highly physical, mm-hmm. really energetic. Right. You can expect to see backflips, front flips, lots of really energetic lifts. We have a huge scaffolding skyline built on the set, which is quite unusual to see in Cambridge, but you'll see our dancers being jumping up onto that, coming down off of it. It's a really highly physical show, so our team have had to work really hard to get in.
What happens to Sarah Brown?
So Sarah is a missionary with the Save a Soul mission. She's looking to save the souls of all of these sinners and gamblers. And she goes on a mission, on her own mission of self-discovery, falling in love, falling out of love, challenging things that she thought she knew for certain. That really is what happens to her through this show. Yeah, I mean, there's certainly moments of huge wit and humour within the script. I mean, it's you know, and... There is the opportunity for tenderness, where you are exploring, despite how much instability at the time, the baby boom, all of the stereotypes of sinners and saviours, let's say, and there is a whole trying to find the humanity in those amongst those stereotypes is part of the show.
To go beyond the stereotypes of the love story, you know, we're dealing with the constraints of women in a very barrier-ridden period for them, and both Sarah and Adelaide are interesting, driven female characters in their own right, navigating those worlds.
What do you think, and do you think it translates into the modern setting quite well, in so much as that we're going through some sort of gloomy period in moral history at the moment?
It's been a hard year for people, right? And I think, that's very similar to what was happening in the 50s, post the war. I think we talk about the romanticism of the gamblers, and their delivery might be quite romanticised, but we've really tried to make sure that we stick with the realness and the grittiness of the stakes of what would have been happening for these boys, why they might have been out on the streets gambling, why they might have been driven underground to do it. Actually, you know, and it's pretty harmless gambling that we're talking about here. It's a real fascinating moral code that society had placed on these gents in this period.
I'm just asking, why do you think people want to romanticise hustlers and gangsters? Because it's one of those things, it's like, you know, The Sting or what have you, you know. People want to see that world as in some way offering something exciting.
Well, I think certainly when it's framed within, you know, we're talking about the golden age of Hollywood here, and where you would go and see the bright lights of Broadway. And when you put a show like Guys and Dolls within that, it's you know, it's quite hard not to glamorize it, really. And there's something that, you know, I think audiences like being able to feel like they can step into the shoes of others and live a life they may not have lived. And I'm not sure about you, but I myself can't say that I've been a gambler through my life and kind of have been driven underground to kind of enact in that way.
We're very lucky in Cambridge because, of course, it's an engineering city, which means we've got access to amazing tech. So we do have this enormous skyscraper that the actors are flipping off, jumping off, catching each other off. So we do a lot of stunt work with the actors to make sure that we have a really physicalised, exciting show. So it is a challenge, but I don't think we've ever encountered a period where we've gone, ooh, we've overstretched anyone. Everyone's very capable, and it's a really exciting example of what is on offer in local theatre here.
What's it like working in the newly revamped Arts Theatre? as one of the first shows to come on when it's as it's reopened, because is it really a very smooth experience in terms of dealing with all the backstage stuff and what have you?
I mean, we coordinate with the theatre pretty well. We've got a slick get-in schedule. It's very tight to time. But also, it's a lovely opportunity. So we've got a black tie gala on our opening night so that people can experience it as they might have done on Broadway, to sort of celebrate the refurb of the arts, but again, also to celebrate what's available here in Cambridge in terms of technical theatre and professional style local theatre.
I look forward to seeing you in the bright lights. Thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge Radio. It's been most interesting talking to you.
That's a pleasure. Thanks.
Imagine being a humble middle-class Victorian interior designer with a small railway worker's house in Cambridge over a century ago, or working in the houses of the wealthy with all the best materials. You might be tempted to save some of the decorative materials and with some artistic flair feather your own nest as you would like in the manner of the well-to-do. However, keeping it a bit of a local secret, since in Victoria times we couldn't be too uppity. This experiment has been beautifully preserved in David Parr House in Guider Street, and there's quite a story to tell. Bob Hewis, visitor experience and house manager, took me for a brief tour.
We've just stepped through a door into David Parr House in Guider Street, and it is really like stepping back in time 100 years or so, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
So tell me a little bit about David Parr himself, because he's one of those kind of extraordinary Cambridge gentlemen who did something quite remarkable within the confines of this amazing building.
Yes, absolutely. So, as you say, David Parr was born here in Cambridge, middle of the 19th century, to quite difficult origins. And he was apprenticed in the decorative arts with a local decorative firm called the Leach Company, F.R. Leach and Sons. So he learned painting and decorating. And when he had earned enough money to purchase his own house here, 186 Guider Street, he started painting in his own home. So he had been working on the homes of the rich and the wealthy, the great and the good, and then he brought that decoration home for his own space. And so that's what you're seeing, yeah, as you stood here in these rooms.
What you're looking at, really, I think, when you look at the decorations inside this room,
yes,
is this kind of expression of artistic talent. But it's the expression of artistic talent during a very constrictive era socially. So in many ways, he's kind of he's let himself go large within this small house, hasn't he?
I like that. Yeah, I like the idea that he's kind of, this is his space for experimentation and for kind of, yeah, creative expression. I like that.
Tell me a little bit about the features of this room, because, I mean, at the moment it's candlelit, so it's very atmospheric. But what have we got around us?
So I usually describe the walls as kind of scrolling foliate. They are kind of very densely ornamented with leaves and vines and flowers, very reminiscent of William Morris designs, which is maybe a name people are more familiar with. And so we often talk about them in the context of the arts and crafts movement, and that kind of design aesthetic.
Yeah. There's a lot of congruence between the different things in the room, because they all kind of match and meld together, don't they?
Yes,
And they're quite colourful. I mean, they're colourful in a kind of very low-key and sort of naturalistic way, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think what David does really well is he kind of captures the beauty of nature, and so the colours are not vibrant and vivid in the way we might think of today, but they're certainly, they have a richness and a depth to them, for sure.
Now, what were the main reasons why this house was saved for posterity, basically?
So, I feel there was a few people and a few chance encounters that led to that. So, David's granddaughter, Elsie Palmer, she lived in the house for almost her entire life, from when she was 12 years old until she passed in 2013, and she really protected much of the original decoration. So that we owe a lot to her for saving this house as it was. And then a local historian was sort of put in touch with Elsie when she was close to, in her elder years. And when she came in, she realized it was something extremely significant and something not quite like anything else she'd seen. So she was able to bring together a group of people, put together a board of trustees, and set up the charity that still preserves the house and opens it to the public.
I mean, you kind of expect someone like Lloyd George or something to walk into the room.
Definitely.
It's quite fun. Okay, so now the artistry and decoration of a house is very uncommon in the era to do it in this kind of flamboyant way within within it.
Yeah, so I think the thing that sort of sets this house apart is its size and kind of the modesty of it as a terraced house. But in reality, this type of decoration was extremely popular amongst the wealthy. So a lot of the richest houses would have decoration much like this. And in fact, David was decorating places like St. James's Palace and other grand estates that did, use this kind of really dense and flamboyant, as you say, decoration. So I think what's really more sort of surprising is that it is here in this particular terraced house in Cambridge that is so incredible. Yeah.
So it's kind of like a well-kept secret.
Exactly.
Yes. I thought there might be an element of that.
Yes.
And then, obviously, there's that kind of feeling here of a kind of Doctor Who-ish kind of experience,
isn't it?
Because you do really feel like you are in another time when you're in this house, because everything is being kept beautifully authentic, it's exactly as it was, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's very consciously not a museum in the sense that there isn't labels or things in the room, so the room is kept as it was when it was sort of discovered, and so there is a real care and attention to detail to the way that we preserve that sense of the house that, as you say, you do kind of step back in time. And also I think it's Doctor Who in the way that you step into somewhere that feels grander than it looks from the outside. So you would have no idea that it looks like this when you step
inside. Tell me, take me through some of the more intriguing, particularly things that intrigue you particularly around the house.
Well, one thing that I love actually in this room is that you can see parts of David's process, like the hand of the artist. So when you look just on the bottom of the wall, you can see little pencil marks that have been left by David where he has created the repeat of the pattern. And so they're tiny marks that you would easily miss. But I think that kind of close looking is rewarded in a place like this, because that's where you really see how this came to be, you know, as a process. Yeah, I love that. Yes. We're in the dining room now, and I think one of the things I love in this room are these panels that you see hanging on the wall, the wording, because we believe David painted those as well, and they have these sort of quips and wits to them that they're really like philosophies that, you know, he kind of lived by, and I think it really gives a sense of how he was as a family man, like what he chose to surround his, you know, family with, because he raised three children, he was married here, and I just love the sentiments that they
show. This is very much a social area, and what you kind of get in this room, what I find, is that you can imagine him with his friends in here, and what social life would have been like back in those days, especially in the candlelight as we are now. And it has that kind of feeling of I don't know, it's an atmosphere, isn't it, that kind of makes you feel that this is how they must have lived in those days. And you can almost envisage it, really, can't you?
I think it's sort of, I mean, I love that in many ways the house is like everybody else's, and in other ways is nothing like anyone else's. And I think that it's those things that are things we can connect to and relate to is what really adds to the atmosphere, I think. Yeah.
So let's go through to the kitchen.
Sure, yes, let's.
Wow, this is great. And is that a mangle?
It is a mangle, yes. And, you know, that's one of the things that I think is part of, you know, 20th century life that is preserved in the house, and sort of something that maybe people who aren't familiar with kind of aren't sure what it is. We have people ask if there's a pasta maker or something. And it's really all of those histories of domestic life that we really look to keep and preserve, in the house.
And then there are all sorts of nice things like the stained glass windows and the colourful curtains, and then patterned motifs on the walls here with blue flowers and things like that, which actually, you know, when you look into the past, you tend to see brown paper, black and white photographs. Mm. You know, there's this lack of detail, this lack of colour, and coming through this house, you kind of see it how it really would have been.
Yeah,
and it makes you look at the past as though it has more life, and you know, that you can actually grasp.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think, yeah, you're right that it's just really a consequence of how we know what we know about the past. Yeah. So through photographs, which were black and white, and also this paint itself, it's varnished, and varnish darkens over time. And so often when you see old houses, they have darkened and changed a lot since when they were first painted. So when you imagine that this was originally a very brilliant white and, you know, a very kind of cornflower blue, it really does, as you say, make the period seem more lively and more jolly than we like think of it. Yeah.
And you've got a wonderful old burning stone here as well, set into the wall,
yes,
made of metal, and that really would have been the centre of all the family cooking and everything else. And I've never actually seen one of these close up before, to see how they actually were. Mm. But that is, it looks like quite a. So you just made a fire down
that's
in this lower part,
yes, here, that's it.
And then just cooked from there.
That's
it. Just warmed up that.
Absolutely.
So it seems quite rudimentary, doesn't
yes.
it? Really.
It is, yeah. And this was put in 1930, so this was sort of for Elsie's family, would have been where they would have cooked. So yeah, it would have, as you say, you know, the heart of the household, I think.
Now there's a strange feature here, isn't there? Because because as far as I understand, nobody had an inside loo along here in those days, but Pa had one put in, didn't he?
Yes, that's it. It's one of those things where, you know, he was bringing in the latest luxuries and the comforts for his family. And so while, yeah, most people on this street probably would still have had outdoor toilets in well into the 20th century, David had this installed much earlier in the night, late in the 19th century, and so really ahead of his time in terms of domestic
comfort. So he was very well to do for his social class, wasn't he, because he made sure that he had all the trimmings and everything, didn't he?
Exactly.
To have sort of a kind of certain standard of civilization and decency within this house, which is decorated absolutely beautifully.
You could see that.
Let's nip upstairs, shall we?
So now we're in the bedroom of where David and Mary Jane, his wife, would have slept, and later where Elsie and Alfred, her husband, would have slept. And this actually, when you were talking about the lightness of what the house kind of reminds us of a past era, this is the best for that because these walls weren't varnished. Mm. So they, you know, maintain the brightness, the vivid colours that they were first painted in. Yes.
So these are reds and greens and yellows on the wall paper, which make it look kind of a very kind of enlivening wallpaper for that era. You know, it's very bright.
That's it. And it's funny you say wallpaper because it's common for people to say that, and it's actually because it's painted straight onto the walls. It's actually not wallpaper, and that's the thing, is it, you know, it can trick people's eyes that they think it must be because it's so symmetrical or it's so perfectly done.
But it's actually artwork.
It's actually, that's artwork, it, painted straight on, yes.
Yeah, and all these, it's a marvellous old bed there, which wasn't very large for a double bed. It's an ordinary size double bed, isn't it?
So, yes, exactly.
And then some paintings of small paintings of birds and things like that, and flowers and what have you. And then that was the wash area, wasn't it? So you just have a large jug and a bowl for your wash area and all the things laid out.
That's it.
That shows what it would be like.
Absolutely.
And a big mirror. So basically, you'd that's how you clean up in the morning, just in a small area like that.
That's it. It's quite a simple setup, but it was enough, I suppose. Yes, for then.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about it that strikes me is we're living in this kind of media computer-controlled age. And this age, you can kind of feel how peaceful it must have been in comparison.
Yes, definitely. Absolutely, yes. I mean, they did have a television. The family of the Palmers living did have a television. But beyond that, yes, no screens and no scrolling. And I think that there was a way that the house was just a place to kind of live and, you know.
There's a kind of cheerfulness about it, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. definitely. We can have a mosey through to the these front rooms here.
Yeah.
These are the last kind of rooms in the house that we look at, really. So now we're in quite a small bedroom, a cosy little space that is the bedroom of presumably one of the children of David Parr. And this room has this amazing frieze of lettering that runs around the top of it, which has, you know, this wording that comes from a prayer, from a hymn. And it's, it's like Gothic lettering is what it looks like. It kind of looks like it's been pulled out from a manuscript, and it really shows David's skills of, you know, calligraphy and handwriting, which are so perfectly designed. So it's really a beautiful piece.
Hasn't he quoted some Shakespeare in the room downstairs? What was that story
about? Yeah, so in the first room we were in, he, over the top of the piano, there's a quotation from a Shakespearean play, and it essentially speaks about finding wisdom in nature, so looking to nature for wisdom. And I think that really resonates not only in Shakespeare's time and what Shakespeare was trying to say, but also in David's time of industrialization and mechanization. You know, the arts and crafts designers and pioneers of the time really were saying that nature is where we can learn so much from. So I think that it shows him as a learned person who knows Shakespeare, but it also speaks to his own philosophies.
What was he like as a man, do you think? How did he fit into society, really? As you say, he used to do things in posh people's houses, you know,
right, yes.
Renovations, things like that. But I mean, how would his life have been? Because he wasn't that well off.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we know kind of very little, which is it's amazing that we know as much as we do, really, because we know a lot about the house and what he did here, because he left a notebook where he recorded everything that he did in the house. But we have very few kind of personal letters or writings from David Parr, and there isn't a kind of neatly kept archive of David Parr's sort of, you know, documents about his life, because he wasn't famous in his own time like other, you know, people that we have more documentation and evidence for. So I think piecing together him as a person is quite tricky, and we really can only go from
the clues in
the clues in the house. That's it. In the last room of the house now, and it's a little less of David present here, but a lot more of Elsie and his granddaughter and her family. So in here we have this coat hanging in the wardrobe, and that was Elsie's husband's coat because he worked on the railways here. And the railway is actually key to so much of the story of the house. I mean, these houses were built because the railway came, you know, to this part of the city in the 1840s. That was why all of these houses were built. And so David travelled on the trains to his various projects, Elsie's husband worked on the trains, and so actually that kind of movement and possibility of transport was so crucial to this house's history,
and
today.
When can people come in and come and have a look at David Parr House, because it's really worth the trip?
Absolutely. And so the house is open for visits Thursdays, Fridays and Saturdays. We recommend that you book online, because it is a modest sized house, and so we do have to, you know, go in groups, very small groups, but it creates such an intimate personal experience that I think it is, as you say, well worth the visit. Yes. We are the house, but also we have our shop and our studio gallery space. So we have exhibitions and contemporary programming, and so it's really worth looking at our website, joining our mailing list to really stay up to date with, you know, everything that's going on around the charity.
Bob Hughes, thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge Radio. It's been most interesting. Thanks for sharing with the house.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Cool, though it is outside, I must now bid you farewell and hope you've enjoyed Cambridge Arts Roundup Hour on Cambridge Radio. I'm Simon Burton, and I'll be back soon with more art stories and cultural news in the city.